Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk podcast. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. You can stay up to date with all things Creative Pep Talk by following me on Instagram at Andy J. Pizza. Let's get into today's super special episode. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site. Anyway, go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. This episode is supported by In The Making, an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express, the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. If you are trying to boost the YouTube, TikTok, Reels content side of what you're doing, one episode of In The Making that I think will be super useful to you is their episode with John Yushai. I think John's method for including his audience in the process is really inspiring. And if you want to hear about that and more about leveling up your game in the creator economy, just search In The Making in your podcast player to listen. Many thanks to In The Making and Adobe Express for their support. What's happening? Oh, I don't know what's happening. Did you read the title of today's episode? Yes. Today on the show, we have none other than legend Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the show. Why is he on the show? Because we are doing a collaboration with his company, Hit Record. Hit Record is a place where creative people can come together from all industries and persuasions and get collaborative. You know that I am constantly telling you guys, you've got to get collaborative if you want to reach your creative career goals. Collaboration has been the bedrock of my creative career breakthroughs, and they can be for you too. Back 10 years ago, it was so much easier to do collaborations online. It was a much more collaborative space, but people got scared, things got weird, and it's really hard to find ways of collaborating online these days. And that's where Hit Record comes in. Hit Record has made it their job to create a safe space that puts artists first, that allows them to come together and make incredible stuff as a community. I've watched Hit Record go from the early days when it was just a community to becoming a production company that won Emmys, making a TV show, and now it's an app. And you can go on there and start your own projects and get calls for collaborators, and that's what we're doing on this episode. So we're coming into our fifth year as a podcast, and we're getting dangerously close to 5 million total listens. And to celebrate, I thought we could collaborate with Hit Record and create a collaborative episode of the podcast to celebrate everything that this show is about. So you, me, Joseph Gordon-Levitt are going to make an episode together. How? Go to hitrecord.org/creativepeptalk and you can participate in the many challenges that we have put up there. Stay tuned for the end of this episode, and I'll give you even more details about how you can be a part of this celebratory episode. There are recording prompts where you record advice for yourself 5 years ago or advice you think your future self would give you. You can re-record the intro of this show. We're going to splice them all up for a special audience introduced version of the show. There's illustration prompts, illustrate an aha moment as it looks like and it's exploding in your head. There's written prompts. You can just write the advice and someone else can read it, or I will read it on the show. And there are even music prompts where you can remix the music from this show. And we're going to have some incredible versions of that too that we're going to be putting in there. Go check it out, hitrecord.org/creativepeptalk. I'm so pumped about this episode. It's going to launch in about 4 weeks, but go check it out because we're going to do it in stages. The first stage is dropping today. All right, we're going to get to the interview, but just one last thing. If you've listened to this podcast more than probably, you know, half an episode, you know that I am a freaking super fan of Fraggle Rock. It's probably my biggest creative inspiration. And I don't know if you know this, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt is slated to produce and star in the Fraggle Rock movie. And I didn't ask him on record, but I may have asked him off record if he could give me any inside scoop to the movie. He couldn't say much, but it was a thrill to ask him. And it was a thrill to have this man on the show. I am a super fan of his work, all the way back to his early indie films in like 2005 to his stuff with Christopher Nolan and Rian Johnson. You are going to have a blast. Here he is, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So, are we good? Good to roll? The first thing I wanted to say was I'm a huge fan, and I feel like...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I feel like I was very nervous of doing like the Chris Farley show thing. Like,
remember when you made Abbey Road?
Christopher Lloyd was an angel, yeah. And you were the only one. You remember? You could.
That was awesome. Yeah.
So if I go, if I start going there, just be like, no,
Chris Farley show.
Yeah, give me some. We got to have some kind of signaling.
Okay.
If I start doing that,
I'm very flattered. That was a flattering preamble.
Okay. But I'm a huge fan. You know, I happened to get Manic when it was sold at Blockbuster, like right after.
That's not one I hear about that much. That's one of my favorite experiences, honestly, and one of my favorite things I've been a part of. It's hard to say the word favorite, right?
Sure.
But it really left an indelible impression on me, that particular project. So thanks for bringing that one up.
Yeah.
That's a little known movie.
I was obsessed with it. I actually ended up doing a little detour early in my illustration career, where basically like a year out of school, I wasn't getting any jobs, mm-hmm. and I'd quit my job and I was in a really tough place. And the only job I could get, my friend helped me get a job at the youth shelter / detention center.
Oh, wow.
I would say it was very accurate.
Yeah.
This vibe in that film.
Really, well, powerful. The writers, Blaine and Mike, and the director, Jordan, really did a lot of research into it. So this is, for those listening who haven't heard of Manic or seen it, it's a movie that all takes place in a psychological lockdown facility, juvenile psychological lockdown facility. And I played a character who couldn't control his anger and almost kills someone with a bat and ends up in this place. And so it's a little bit of a similar setting to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in a way.
Yeah, true.
But that was, you know, after having done comedy on TV for many, many years, all I really wanted to do was something really serious and intense, and no one really thought of me that way, which is understandable.
Yeah.
And I have to hand it to Jordan, who directed that movie, for, you know, he really put me through it. He had me audition many times.
Really?
Because I think everyone was like, wait, what? You're going to cast that kid from Third Rock from the Sun to play the dude in the psychological lockdown facility who almost killed someone with a bat and it can't control his rage?
That's a big leap.
That's who you're going to pick? And he took that leap, and I really, really thank him for it. And in many ways, that movie is, if I had to pick a turning point in the, I feel pretentious talking about my career,
please,
but like, but it kind of is that, actually,
because yeah,
that's the movie that then, Greg Araki saw, who put me in Mysterious Skin, who directed Mysterious Skin. That's the movie that Rian Johnson saw, who directed Brick. And those two movies, when they played at Sundance, were kind of what allowed me to then start being considered for roles that were dramatic, that mm-hmm. weren't Third Rock from the Sun and 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah.
And it's also, Manic is where I met Zooey Deschanel.
First collaboration with her.
Yeah. And I think our makeout scene in Manic is one for the ages, right, and one of the hottest makeout scenes in movie history.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that because that might be weird. But yeah. Okay. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, yeah. But,
and Don Cheadle. Don Cheadle is fantastic in it.
Amazing.
Mike Bacall, who co-wrote that movie and also stars in it, as a lifelong friend, as well as Eldon. I mean, Cody, everyone was so, so great in that. I love that movie.
Yeah. And, I was obsessed with it.
I'm so happy you know it, man. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
I got into Brick after that, super into that, and I kind of watched hit record, start, and everything else. So I'm a legitimate fan.
That's really cool. Thank
that's
you.
That's why I have the possibility of going to Chris Farley.
Yeah.
But let's go back a little bit to, I feel like for a lot of people, their journey is Hollywood is like this extraordinary place. Like that's the place they leave home to go there.
Yeah.
And so for you, it was almost like the opposite, where Hollywood was ordinary world and your hero's journey, and you had to leave it to find something different. But what was it like growing up in Hollywood? We don't have to spend ages there, but just paint that picture a little bit about how that felt
sure.
for this to be normal.
Yeah. So I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. I went to Van Nuys High. The Valley is a suburb. And if you know, to orient it around Hollywood. So Hollywood, you see the Hollywood sign on a hill. Yeah. Those are the Hollywood Hills. If you go over the Hollywood Hills to the other side of where Hollywood isn't, and you go into the suburbs, that's what we call the Valley.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm from. And so all the auditions and stuff that you go on are just a relatively quick trip over the hill into Hollywood. And when I got started doing it, it was a pretty normal beginning, in that I was in a kid's choir, pretty much similar to any kid's choir we did. And then we started doing like musicals.
Yeah.
Same teacher taught musicals, but it was, I think, like pretty much anybody else would do kind of community theater in any suburb in this country. But because it was a suburb right over the hill from Hollywood, some of the kids
People
that were in those musicals
around.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, Alexander and Sebastian, if I'm not mistaken, were these two other, you know, boys. When I'm talking, we're probably, I don't know, 5 years old or 6 years old in this
picture. These don't sound like Holly or Ohio boys. These do sound like Hollywood boys.
Because they're named Alexander and Sebastian. Oh,
yeah,
really?
I don't know. At least in that era. Now people are more adventurous with their names. But yeah.
That's funny.
Sure.
Yeah, nowadays it would be what? Aiden and...
Jaden.
And Caden and Bryson.
That's right.
Sorry no if anybody's named that.
Anybody. we'll cut that out.
Yeah. So they did auditions and were in commercials and shows and stuff. And so they had a kid's manager who came to our production of maybe Grease or whatever it was, and asked,
"Were you like a kid, Danny Zuko?"
I in Grease, I think I didn't get a big part in Grease. Right. I was a kid Nathan Detroit though, and I was a kid Peter Pan.
Yeah,
and I was with Miss Karen, who taught choir and taught, who's a wonderful and inspiring
Shout out to
teacher.
Ms. Karen.
Yeah, love Miss Karen. So So she asked, this manager asked my mom if I wanted to go on some auditions. My mom asked me, and my mom and my dad were never anything but supportive.
Yeah.
They were never pressuring at all. They were encouraging to the point where they encouraged me to do anything that I liked doing. They were also really encouraging that I do gymnastics and, you know, play flag football. But they could see I really liked doing this. And, you know, I think we were just in the fortunate enough position that luckily my mom didn't have to work. My dad, you know, earned enough money
yeah.
so that my mom didn't have to work. So she could drive me to auditions. So that's a piece of luck.
Yeah.
A lot of this is just good luck. Right. I think, you know, if you're going to talk about success in the professional or the commercial sense of the word success,
yeah.
so much of it is luck. Mm. And anybody that says it's not, I think is, I'm not saying it's 100% luck.
Sure.
But I think luck is a huge component.
Yeah.
That,
right place, right time, all those factors.
When it comes to commercial success, yeah. if there's other, I think, other ways to think about success when it comes to being creative.
Sure.
And that's, I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, we will. Yeah.
But when it comes to commercial success, a lot of it's luck. I happen to be, you know, born and raised in a suburb of Los Angeles where the auditions were just over the hill. I happened to, you know, grow up in a family where my mom could drive me to auditions.
The privileges of all that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. Those are, you know, those are
huge.
Good bits of luck. Yeah.
But I just have to push back a little bit, give yourself some credit. How many people, were child actors and then were not able to reinvent themselves the way that you did? And
yeah. sure.
I mean, there's
something there.
Yeah, that's not completely luck.
I appreciate it.
You obviously
had
some network and stuff, but ultimately that's huge. So you're making these movies, you're on TV, you're doing all that stuff, and it's pretty well known that you took a break mm-hmm. from Hollywood. You left that ordinary and went to the extraordinary of being a normal college student.
Mm-hmm.
What were you wanting to achieve by doing that?
Kind of just what you said. I think I just wanted to be a normal college student.
Yeah.
I had my whole life had this thing that differentiated me from other kids my age. And on the one hand, I was very happy to have that differentiation. I loved getting to act, but there were certainly plenty of moments throughout where I was like, oh, I didn't get to do this, or I didn't make it to that. Like,
yeah.
you know, I mentioned flag football a second ago. When I was 9, I was on a team, the Bengals. We were yeah. great. And we went all the way to the championship game, and most of the games were on the weekend.
Yeah.
But the championship game was on a Tuesday night, and it just so happened that the show I was working on at the time, which was called Dark Shadows,
right.
it was like a vampire show in the early 90s,
yeah.
And I was 10,
yeah.
and or 9. And the championship game was on a Tuesday night, and we just so happened to be doing a night shoot, and I was there on set looking at the clock, being like, maybe we'll get done.
Yeah.
Oh, the game's starting. Well, maybe we'll get done in time. You know, I had my uniform and my cleats car so I could go straight from work to
the
game.
You're going to make me cry.
Well, so, yeah, so, I mean, I don't mean
so
to
did
say.
Did you make it? You
no,
didn't?
Oh, no. They won without me, which
oh,
is
no.
even worse.
Oh, they didn't even meet you.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, so, like, it's not to say, like, oh, woe is me.
Sure.
It's fucking awesome that I got to be, yeah. like, working on Dark Shadows. I'm just saying that I was, to your point, what was I looking for moving away? I was looking for just, like, a more normal experience. And I also wanted to know, like, okay, I don't want to have decided my life's calling at age 6 and never question it again.
Yeah.
I wanted to see, like, maybe I'll want to do something entirely else. Maybe I'll want to end up becoming a lawyer or a scientist or just something totally else. But within, you know, my freshman year of college was the longest break I'd ever taken away from working.
Yeah.
And just those 9 months, I was already itching to I was like dressing up in costumes and like going out and, you know, being at restaurants, like doing voices and like stuff that I actually don't do nowadays because I think I'm scratching that itch.
You have an outlet for all that stuff. Yeah.
And it wasn't long before I was wanting to get back.
What did you start doing? What did it look like to, you know, I know you discovered editing, mm-hmm. and it was more simple and with the computer. And what did you start, just tinkering on stuff? Did you start making calls to your agent saying, I'd like to audition again? Like what did that look like?
Yeah, well, I wanted to start acting again.
Yeah.
And, but I didn't want to do another, television comedy, and I didn't really want to do like teen romantic comedies either. And most of the agents didn't have any belief that I would be able to do anything else.
Yeah.
And there was one agent named Warren Zavala, who was at first an assistant of another agent of mine, and he got his desk, as they say, that he became an agent.
Yeah.
And called me and was like, I think you're great. And I think if you want to do this other stuff, then you should do it and let me send you scripts and things. And, yeah. And I was like, well, no, I told myself I was going to like go to college and not do that. And he was like, well, let me just send you stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And he's still my agent, and he's those phone calls happened in what, I guess like 2000, 2001. And he's really risen and built an amazing career for himself and works with all kinds of amazing, talented artists. But I really am eternally grateful to him, and we have a wonderful working relationship that I think, you know, is rare, honestly, from what I've seen of how people oftentimes relate to their agents. Yeah.
So because I know you didn't finish college, correct? That sounded like I was your mom or something.
I know you didn't.
And where's the degree? Show us it. But I know you didn't. Why? Because you had set your target. You're like, I'm going to finish this thing. He's sending you roles. You're like, I'm not sure about it. In here, I'll just give you a little preface or whatever. Mm-hmm. It seems like in this season of time, there was some kind of magic that you found, that you've carried on through your creativity, that you've embedded into Hit Record. There's something going on in that season when you start editing and just hitting record, that kind of thing, that you found some elixir that you're still, however long later, trying to get to people.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to, like, what is it that started scratching that itch or got you to be like, all right, I'm out of college. I got to go back and do this thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I love how you asked that. I would say that the story continues to say that even though Warren sent me scripts, no one cast me in anything.
Right. Okay.
And so it came out of...
you wanted to do some of them.
Oh, yeah. And I was really trying to get all kinds of jobs, and no one would give me a job acting.
Yep.
And I think, you know, that was very painful. And I imagine folks listening to this have experienced this. If, you know, the title of this podcast is Creative Pep Talk, this is probably addressing exactly this feeling.
These are the people listening.
Yeah, that this is, I was feeling this incredible desire to be creative, to express myself, and yet I was not being given the opportunity to do so.
You weren't getting permission. Yeah.
And when your mode of expression is acting, then you're kind of reliant.
You're the last link in the chain.
Yeah.
Not unlike illustrators. They're waiting on emails to be like, okay, we have the product, we have the campaign. The last person they hire is the illustrator.
Oh, there
so
you
you're
go.
Sat around. I make all that comparison to acting and actors that go on to write and stuff to, you know, get out of that position or whatever. But yeah,
that's interesting.
Totally,
I never thought
that
of illustration that way. I didn't actually know that.
If you're doing it for clients as your main source of income, and you're not making stuff for people, and you're not doing your own self-initiated stuff, and a big theme on this project, on this podcast, is self-initiated projects.
Yes.
I call them side quests.
Uh-huh.
And Yeah, it's exactly.
If you're a hired gun.
Yeah.
Because that's if you're an actor for hire, you're a hired gun, and you're right, you're the last one. The team has been putting together a movie for probably years.
Yeah.
And then about 2 months before they roll camera, they hire you, the actor.
So you're waiting. And,
yeah, you're just waiting
on them. Yeah. Yeah.
And that became untenable because no one was casting me, and I had this urge bubbling up, and I had to do something else. And that's where I started saying to myself this kind of mantra or this battle cry of hit record.
Yeah.
And the red record button, that circle became a symbol for me of I'm going to push the button. I'm not going to be just the hired gun actor that's waiting for someone else to point the camera at me and hit the button. I'm going to hit the button.
Yeah.
And metaphorically so, whether that means, you know, recording audio and making a song, or whether that means just writing a story or making little short films and editing them together or anything. I just had to start making stuff myself. And and luckily I was able. And that goes back again to luck.
Yeah.
I had spent a bunch of my childhood working, so I had saved money.
Sure.
And I could afford to do that, to like spend time at my house and teach myself how to edit.
Yes.
That's another piece of good luck.
Sure.
That's worth acknowledging.
100%. I totally agree with that. Look, and also luckily, the democratization of all these tools has not completely played out, but it's a lot easier to make something now than it was, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You couldn't make a film. You couldn't make any of that stuff.
So that's at least just
you
have
a media company in your pocket.
That's it. Well, and that was the nail in the coffin for college. Was I got, for my 21st birthday, I gave myself a copy of Final Cut Pro. And it was the first time I'd ever had editing software. And I'd grown up making little videos on, you know, Hi-8 cassettes and things like that with my friends. But editing them was always, if not impossible, very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that I had good editing tools just at my disposal.
Yeah.
And I was hooked. I just would stay up all night making things. And it was so, so, so fun. And at that point, I was like, okay, I can spend my time writing this paper for class, or I can keep editing.
Yeah.
And that's when I dropped out of college.
I'm super, I have some theories, but I'm super curious why editing is such a spark for you. Like if you had a sensitivity to that, well, you know, I like the idea of like, you ever heard someone say like, you can't write and edit at the same time? Like if you separate that.
Yeah.
And I imagine if you don't have the ability to edit, you know, making your own videos or whatever, even creatively, is like a lot, because you're like, we got to get it in one take and it's got to be perfect or whatever.
Yeah, the editing is when it turns into a movie.
Yeah.
Before that, you're shooting moments.
Yeah.
And you're gathering footage, and the moments can be amazing as they happen. That's why the domain of actors is really the theater.
Mm-hmm.
The domain of film is film is not the actor's domain.
Yeah.
And I'd been a film actor my whole life, whether film or TV, same thing. And
it's the director's medium.
It's the director's medium.
Yeah.
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 And the director's arguably their biggest tool is the editing.
Yeah.
So getting to take these moments that I would capture, and the stuff that I was editing, almost none of it was like films in the conventional sense. It's not like I was writing scripts and getting together casts or crews or anything. I was just like carrying a camera around with me and shooting stuff. But just the chance to then edit it together and decide on the timing and then how the music was going to play.
Those
and
moments.
Like, yeah, that's the medium of cinema or whatever you want to call it. And I think it was sort of like a lot of pent up of always participating in part of that process, but then never getting to really express myself in where it all actually comes together into the piece of work or art that gets presented to an audience. And so finally getting to do that was hugely satisfying.
Yes. And whenever, you know, I think a lot about one thing we talk about on the podcast all the time is like, what are you wanting to produce in your audience? What do you know, what feelings do you want them to feel? What, and a lot of that happens with the, you know, the perfection of all these layers coming together.
Yes.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So how does that relate to, does that relate directly to how Hit Record comes along?
Yeah.
Okay. How does that happen? You're, as far as I know, you're starting to load up some of this stuff online and it's basically housed at Hit Record.
Yeah. Right? I mean, and before we even started a website called Hit Record, like I said, it was just this little turn of phrase that I would say to myself for motivation or in my moments where I'd be like, oh fuck, like,
yeah,
I can't this or I'm not that. I'm just like, just be quiet and hit record and
yeah,
I'm going to do it. And then, yeah, so I started making things and I wanted to put them up online somewhere. And this was in the mid 2000s. 2005 was the very, very, very first version of hitrecord.org, this website that my brother Dan helped me set up. And it was, you know, I didn't hear about YouTube till 2006. And it was just a little bit before it became super normal and easy to just post a bunch of stuff on these big platforms.
Yeah.
And my brother was a coder and he was like, well, start your own website. And so we did. And it was just very, very tiny. It was one page of HTML with some links to the videos and things and songs and stories I was making. And it was that for a while. And it was
your thing, really. At the start, it was just your,
yeah, that's
your
right,
collection of stuff. That
between 2005 and 2007, it was just, yeah, it was like, here's me and the things that I'm making.
Yeah.
And you might know me because you might have seen me in a movie or something, but here's like the stuff I'm making by myself. And then in 2007, we decided to put a message board on it. And it was actually a big, harrowing decision, even though it was still this tiny thing. It was,
yeah,
it wasn't about the size or the scope in terms of, I don't know, usership or whatever. For me, it was like, this is my outlet. This is my personal thing. And do I want to let anybody come and post their comment or their file or whatever on my thing? And at first I was like, I don't know if I want to do that. The internet can be a really negative place.
Yeah.
And it was my brother who was like, why don't we just try it? It'll be easy. We'll put this just prefabricated message board on there. We can always take it down if we're not liking it. It'll be fun. It'll be interesting. Because we used to hang out on old like BBS boards.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long time ago. And when I was really young, BBS for bulletin board system. And this was back in like before everything was a graphical user interface, but it was just, you know, text-based DOS. You're on like a 2400 dial-up modem dialing some local person who has a bunch of phone lines and you can like chat with other people and whatnot on with text. And we used to do that. He was really into that. And of course he's my big brother. So I was into what he was into.
You're always educated. They teach you how to, what taste to have and what, activities to do. Yeah.
So this was our chance to kind of have our BBS. And so we started it and, what started happening really surprised us because it wasn't negative. It was actually really sweet. People were being really cool and it was enormously fulfilling, like surprisingly so. I thought it was going to be like, And it ended up being a really meaningful thing for me, this little community that started to form. And then the thing that we noticed that really surprised us was people weren't just talking about the little videos and songs and stories that I was making. People wanted to make things together.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, now that's cool. And that's also legitimately new.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just watching a video on the internet is not really that different than what you can do with old technology. That's like watching TV.
Sure.
Same with listening to a song. You could listen to a song on the internet. It's not that different from the old technology of radio. But using the internet to have people come together and make things together that they might not have been able to make on their own, that's a categorically different behavior enabled by this new technology. This couldn't have happened any other time in history. This is really cool. And so we sort of leaned into trying to encourage that collaborative creativity on this little message board. Mm. And like I said, my brother was a coder, so we started, like, I would design and he would code, and we would come up with them together, these little features to try to encourage people to collaborate more. And we dedicated a lot of time to it, even though we weren't spending any money on it. We weren't intending to make any money on it. This was not a startup. This was not a company. This was just a fun thing that my brother and I were doing together. And it kept growing, and the collaborations kind of kept getting more and more interesting. And that's when I started talking with my friend Jared about, could this power a production company? So in 2010, we launched it as a production company.
And I know there's like a new iteration. I want to get to that too. But I have a curiosity, because I think anybody that has kind of followed your career, even in a loose way, watched a lot of these, you know, this person who's in Rian Johnson movies and Christopher Nolan movies and these crazy things. And I think everybody's question with that is, what's this energetic driver on Hit Record? There's a missional thing of like, there's something about something you got from it on a creative level, even early on, of just Hit Record. They're like a, like I said, like an elixir, like the something that you needed, you got, and then you saw other people getting it. And then you've been on this mission for, I don't know how long, a decade or whatever, to get that to as many people as possible, because there's some kind of switch that maybe happened in you. And so I want to just camp out and like, how did that early experience impact your creative career? I feel like I'm just going to address a slight elephant in the room. My show is a creative career podcast.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've heard you on a few podcasts chafe at the word career. This is very awkward relationship between creativity and career.
Yeah.
It's like a really awkward dance, hard thing to pull off. But it seems like something that happened early days in Hit Record gave you something that impacted your journey as an artist.
Yeah.
What do you know? Is that true? Do you think that there's a correlation there?
Yeah. It's funny. First, you're noticing something about me chafing at the word career. And I don't even know if I quite noticed that about myself, but I think it's true. And I'm just trying to think of why that is. I think it's probably some kind of old deep seated hang up of mine from being young and being self-conscious, being 16 and none of my peers having careers yet and not wanting to identify with that word, probably.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It feeling pretentious of me to...
Weird or, you don't fit in because you have that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's often a conflation, depending on what you mean by the word career, between creativity and professional. This gets to what I was talking about a second ago, kind of professional or commercial success with creativity, which I've been lucky to experience. And so I in no way mean to dismiss its value, but I also just don't think that that's the most fulfilling part of creativity for me. Sorry, the cops are coming.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's a very authentic podcast. Yeah. That's totally fine.
But I feel like there can be and maybe Hit Record is this, and maybe that's like the elixir you're talking about, is the nourishing of the creative part of myself that's outside of my quote unquote career, professional career.
Yeah. It seems like to me, the reason why I started talking to Hit Record about collaborating is because, you know, back in earlier days of the internet, it was a safer spot to collaborate. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff was happening, and you know, corporations moved in, and they're, you know, now we're getting into issues of how they're using our stuff. And I think all the creative people got scared of putting their stuff up there, collaborating with other people. And there's, you know, and I think to me, what I liked about Hit Record is it's kind of a safe space to make stuff. And there's people in charge there that are trying to take care of the creative people's rights, make it safe, make it work. And I think in the same way, I have this, you ever heard like John Cleese talk about the open and closed mode?
No.
He has this huge thing on open versus closed mode in terms of the way that your brain functions. And the open mode is like very playful. And the closed mode is like executive decisions, like productivity.
Yeah.
And they're really, they can't exist in the same space.
I think they're actually, I'm no neuroscientist, but I think those are physically actually different parts of your brain.
100%.
Yeah.
Yes. And they're, you know, it's a zone.
Yeah.
And so for me, hit record, you know, knowing the way that you've always talked about it, what you guys have ensured to take care of creative people. You know, I've been pushing my audience, you've got to figure out ways to collaborate, both for creativity, both for career. You've got to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. Makes you better. And there's not a lot of safe places to do that. And there's also not a lot of safe places that are just the open zone, just like where we're not. And the way he talks about it, sorry, I'm like going on a huge monologue.
Yeah, go ahead.
But this thing, I always talk about it like you can't, like Michael Jordan can't get in the zone if he has to ref the game at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Like you can't, if you're thinking the whole time of, is this going to make money?
Yeah.
Is this good?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And to me, hit record, it seems like that you found that zone of like, I'm just going to make stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you want to get it to people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's why when you're an actor, you need a director. Because you can't be thinking about whether that was a good take.
Exactly.
You just have to be doing it, and you just have to believe this is a great take. Every take is great. You can't be looking at yourself that way. You have to trust someone else to look at yourself that way. And yeah, I do think that's a big part of the value of collaboration for anybody creative, is the chance to get into the what you're calling an open mode, get into that flow state where you're not editing, you're just
the improv flowing people say, through don't think.
Yeah. And then it's oftentimes difficult for you yourself to have the perspective to then take what's valuable about that kind of brain dump and edit it into something that will be relatable to other people, other audiences, and collaboration is key for that. And yeah, you're right. You know, platforms like a lot of the media tech platforms nowadays, they're not built for collaboration. Cause that's not how they make money. They make money just by getting as much attention as possible. And what seems to be getting the most attention is just people kind of posting about themselves.
Yeah.
And doing it themselves. And there isn't, I mean, of course, you can find everything on YouTube. You can find everything on Instagram. They're so big. There's tons of great stuff. And there's tons of people collaborating. But they don't actually collaborate using YouTube. They maybe find each other on YouTube. And then they go off and figure out a way to collaborate. YouTube has nothing to do with it until they are finished with their collaboration and it's time to post it. We're trying to build a platform now that's all about that collaborative process where you can come here and find someone to collaborate with and communicate with them and set up your project and see what the steps are and recruit the different people that you need and get it finished. And then, yes, the final step being, then celebrate it once it's done. But what about all the best part, the juiciest, most joyful part in my experience is all the stuff that comes before it's done when you're doing it. And that's the ecosystem we're building now is a place that really puts the emphasis there.
It sounds like all that you have so much passion about it, which I freaking love, but that thing of learning, I don't need someone's permission. I don't have to wait for someone to call me and say, yes, I can just start making. And actually that's what releases that itch, the doing of it. And you learn that with Hit Record. And now you've spent all this time and energy trying to get that experience and that truth to as many creative people. And so you had turn into the forum, turn to the production company, and now it's a new iteration to push it to even more people to have that experience. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So as the production company that we launched in 2010 was a great way for us to make all kinds of art with this collaborative process. And, you know, we've published books, we've put out records, we've
Emmy-winning TV show.
Yeah, we made a TV show that won an Emmy. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we've always, whenever one of these productions makes money, we pay people. We're just about to, this next payment we're about to issue, we'll cross $3 million that we're that we've paid to people since 2010.
Yeah.
And we're really proud of everything we've all been able to do as a production company. The limit is when we're the ones always leading the projects, only so many people are able to get involved.
Yeah.
And there's been, we've over the years tried to say like, hey, we don't have to be always the ones leading the projects, but we never really built a user experience that was good enough to let lots of people, and sort of like intuitive enough to let lots of people in an organized fashion start their own projects, find collaborators, and finish things on their own.
Yeah.
So that's what we want to build now. And the big change is, so we, just getting into the business of it for a second, because I do think that that's, it's important. This is maybe a tangent, but
I have ADD. I don't know. So my audience is enjoys the tangents.
So here's a tangent that I think is worth talking about in terms of a creative pep talk. I think when I was younger, I took the position, probably pretty normal position, that art and business are separate, and a real artist ignores business, and a real artist just leaves that to like the suits or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll be over here doing my art, and you suits over there, you do your thing. And the more I've experienced, the more I've realized that that's, I think that was a naive way for me to see creativity. That, you know, I've mentioned a couple times some of the practical matters that made a huge impact on my ability to be creative. Where I grew up, the fact that my dad earned enough money such that my mom had the time to drive me to auditions. Like, these are the same practical matters that make up a business.
Yeah.
That allow for, you know, there is no, you can't do your painting if you don't have paper and the paint. And it's just like, how it
or a
is
house a roof yeah, over your
a
head.
House to live in and some food to eat earlier. 100%. So and that, you know, that's the simple way of putting it, but it actually just gets more and more complicated the more I've been involved in, like, when I directed a movie called Don John. Once you start directing and not just acting, I learned, like, man, there's just so much overlap between the logistical part of figuring out, okay, we have this budget, we need to make the movie look like this. What are our options? Like, we can't do this, we can't do this. And oftentimes, actually, sometimes those logistical realities will impose limits that then inspire new creative ideas that become some of your favorite parts of the thing, you know? So
yes, 100%. Actually, when I was first starting out, I'd mentioned to you earlier that like a year into my career, it was like right at the recession, all my jobs dried up. And, you know, I always say that's when I hit rock bottom. And some people hit rock bottom and turn to terrible things. My terrible things were business books and business magazines. And I would read them, and I was doing it like thinking.
So you're calling it terrible because like we as artists are sort of raised to think that business books are like bad.
Evil. I call it toxic creative mythology. It's like we're given these ideas about, you know, I feel like a sellout.
A sellout,
out a different cover on this book, a different jacket. And I'm reading these books, and the thing that blew my mind as I'm reading the magazines and books is the people that they're the like unicorns of business, the people that have done these crazy things, are the people I relate to most in. Like, I'm like, those are just creative people. They're just doing creative things. Like, you know, I think Steve Jobs is an excellent example of that. And there's an infinite list of all these They're treating business as a creative endeavor.
Yeah.
And even you talking about the how you use the budget, the choices that you're making on an intuitive level, I find a lot of creative satisfaction after I made the leap.
Yeah.
And I think, and the other thing about that is when we leave all the, I don't think there's anything inherently evil about people that are predisposed to business, but if you leave it all to them, you get systems like we've had, which is they control all the power and they're on, they're making all of the money and all that. And so
they've designed a business model that inadvertently, when I say they, I mean, you know, but I mean, I guess we can also be specific. There's a, cause there's a couple giants.
Sure. Yeah.
And, and, but they've designed a business model that really isn't conducive to the creative process. And it is very conducive to making money.
100% and making them money,
exactly.
Not necessarily making, you know, I'm kind of getting on my soapbox, but that, and that's that whole thing of, open versus closed. Like, open is creative and it's actually play, and play inherently is not about productivity. Like, you can't play and be like, we're gonna have a half an hour play session and get some stuff done. That's instantly not fun. Right, that's not play.
That's interesting. I don't know, I would push you back on that a little bit, like, just exploring this, but you know,
please
play a sport.
Yeah,
for example, you play a game of basketball and part of what makes it fun is there's a clock,
winning, and yeah totally true. We can camp out there too, but I totally, I think there's like hacking your brain. John Cleese, his thing was he would do Monty Python. He would write and he would say, I'm going to write for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I have, the only thing I have to be productive in is that I enjoyed being in that room writing.
I love that.
And so it's a weird, but if a creative's in charge, they can set the boundaries and the constraints to maximize creativity, not just dividends for the people in charge.
So that's exactly what I'm trying to do now. And I and a, an office full of people here are trying to do is build build a new sort of rule set, build a new ecosystem, a platform with a different set of incentives that is focused around that creative process, and to evolve from the production company business model to, you know, something that's more encouraging of not just us leading the productions, but anybody to be able to come and do this and start their own project or find a project to get involved with and have that creative experience by collaborating with other people in a more limitless way. Because again, the limit before was when we're leading the projects, there's only so many people that can get involved
in each
of those.
So it's just more people are getting this.
So what that meant was building new and better technology. We only ever had a very limited team of engineers. We had pretty much nobody at, I shouldn't say pretty much nobody. It was our third co-founder, Mark, was designing all of the website and app. But the reason I say nobody is because his background isn't in product design.
Right, yeah.
His background is in graphic design and architecture. So we didn't have any more trained and experienced product design people, UX, UI, that stuff, like all, because there's a real art and science to it, just like there's an art and a science to making movies. And you wouldn't, you know, necessarily expect that someone with an adjacent skill set would be able to come and be the director of photography on a big movie.
Right.
They might have, you know, Mark did a really great job by himself. He really, really did. But now that he's leading a team of product and UX and UI people, he's so much happier. He's like, the quote he said I loved the other day, he was like, it feels like I have a superpower now.
Yeah,
and
that's amazing.
So it's been awesome to be able to assemble a bigger team. And getting back to the business, what that meant was raising money.
Yeah.
And so we went and did the whole thing. We went up to Silicon Valley. We didn't want to raise money from Hollywood, even though that probably would have been easier because that's where my connections are. But we wanted to go to Silicon Valley because we knew that it was the technology we really needed help with.
Yeah.
And we pitched Silicon Valley investors. We found a really great syndicate of investors. And now we've been able to hire more engineers and more product people, and we're now building the tools that I think are going to empower the community to do what we've kind of always wanted to do, but do it much better and do it in a much more accessible way so more people can get involved more easily. And it's a really, really exciting time right now.
Yeah, it is incredible. And I'm so thrilled to bring our audience on board to do a collaboration. It's kind of honestly what I've been looking for. I've been doing the podcast for 5 years. I'm always harping on about, I don't know how you're going to find the collaborators, but just you got to do it. I know that. And so I was so pumped to see this new iteration. And we're doing a project. We don't have to go into all the details of it, but one part of it is what we're going to do, advice you wish you would have told your younger self, best advice you have to give anybody now. And then my favorite is what future you, for maybe 5 years from the future, what do you think they would come back and tell you today?
Uh-huh.
So that's my question to you to wrap it all up. What do you think Joe 5 years from now is going to come back and say to you right here?
Oh man, 5 years from now. I think 5 years from now, what I hope that my 5 year from now self comes back to me and says is, hey, dude, it all worked out. It didn't work out the way you thought it was going to, but it all worked out. And it all worked out. So you could have just enjoyed it the whole time. You didn't have to spend all that time anxious and eating your fingernails and hating yourself.
Yes.
'Cause, look, I spend some time that way. I wish I didn't. And it's, you know, I think every human being fluctuates back and forth between those moments of joy and those moments of cringeworthy self-hatred. but yeah, I would hope that, yeah, my 5 year from now self would come back and be like, just those are pointless. You don't need to. It's you're going to get to where you're going to get. And you got there. You did. And like I said, it's not what you thought it was going to be. And that's fine. You can't see the future. But it's like, and maybe even something tragic happens. And, you know, I've lived through some tragedy too. And that's terrible, but it's part of it. And there's nothing wrong with feeling pain, especially in the face of tragedy. But if it's not a tragedy, if it's just like you getting anxious about whatever, and it's not tragic. It's just like, oh, I'm, you know.
Are we going to hit the number?
Yeah, we're going to hit the number. Yeah. Does my thing suck? Or like, that's not a tragedy. And you don't need to generate that pain for yourself. Why not relax and just like do what you were saying who was it that Cleese said, like, Cleese. Hey, my mandate to myself is I'm going to enjoy myself while I'm doing this. That's the most important thing. I think that's something I would hope that my 5 year from now self comes back, would come back and tell me.
That is so great. And I'm glad that you didn't say that your future self would come back as Bruce Willis and try to kill you. that's better. That's a better message that you
Chris,
had.
Chris Farley.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I had to do it. I couldn't help it. I saw the opportunity. Well, thank you so much for doing this, man. This was a dream come true, honestly.
Well, thanks, man. Thank you. It was a great conversation. Awesome. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, so much for being on the show. If you didn't get it, that last silly part was a reference to the movie Looper, Rian Johnson's movie with Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. You should definitely go check it out. It's super, super good, and it's about time travel. I didn't want to front load this episode with too much blabber, but I figured I'll end it with a little bit more. Man, this was such a sweet moment for me creatively to get a chance to interview one of my creative heroes, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's work. I keep almost calling him Joe because that's what everybody at Hit Record calls him. I don't. It feels disrespectful somehow. So I'll just keep saying it. Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He had a huge impact on me creatively. Right when I was getting creative, right when I started getting into this creative career path, was right when he was doing these indie films like Manic and Brick, and they really inspired a deeper artistry in me. And so it's incredible to have him on the show and be a part of the creative pep talk history and to do this collaboration with this company, you know, I try to give so much. I try to give as much as I possibly can to you guys every single week. And I try not to ask very much of you, but I am asking you to please help me celebrate our 5 years and 5 million downloads by going to hitrecord.org/creativepeptalk and answer one of these challenges. Some of these challenges are super easy. You can do them right then and there. Some of them take a little bit more time and energy, but come collaborate with me. Come collaborate with Joe. You heard his answer to what his future self might give him advice on. Love to hear yours. So you can submit that writing or recorded. And what a freaking treat to talk to the guy behind the Fraggle Rock movie that's slated to come out. Man, oh, this was a freaking dream for me. In the next couple weeks, we're going to keep hitting you with phases of this collaboration. And in about 4 to 5 weeks, we're going to launch the community created episode where I'm going to give you my advice from the to the past and from the future and some all kinds of great stuff. So stay tuned for that stuff. We're going to do some episodes on collaboration in the meantime. Just a quick heads up, the episode that we make collaboratively that will air in a few weeks will have no sponsors, so we won't be making money on that, just to make it clean as a collaboration with all of you. So we're going to forego sponsorship on that episode. Also, if this is the first episode of Creative Pep Talk that you've ever heard and you like what you heard and you don't know where else to get started, check out episode 202. It's called For When You Feel Like Giving Up. That's a good one if you're frustrated in your creative career. Episode 229 is probably my favorite episode. It's about this theory on taste. It's called The 6-Step Process to Unlocking Powerful Creative Business Momentum. And talking about self-initiated work like the stuff that Joe was doing with Hit Record, episodes 192 to 196 is my side quest series for doing self-initiated work that gets results for you. Go check those episodes out. Again, thanks to the Hit Record team, Vivian and Matt, for making this possible. And thanks to Joe for taking the time out of his super busy schedule to record this conversation with a silly man such as myself. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Alex Sugg for our soundtrack. Thank you, massive freaking thanks to Chris Graham of Chris Graham Mastering. Thanks to all of you who have made these past 5 years just extremely special to me. And I'm so excited to work with you quite possibly the most special episode to date. So don't forget to check that out. And until we speak again, stay pepped up.